You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And on our show today, our studio guest is novelist Judith Lennox. We'll also be hearing from children's author Victor Watson and storyteller and historian Chip Colquhoun. Judith, good morning and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Lee.
Nice to have you with us. We're going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but Chip is talking about his book, Who Made England? Well, never mind England. You're very popular in England, Judith, but you are a megastar in Germany. You are very, very popular in Germany.
My books do well in the German-speaking part of Europe, yes.
You're being very modest there. Why do you think particularly in Germany?
It's very hard to say. I suspect it's a combination of reasons. I think I sort of came in at the right time when my sort of book was on the rise, when there weren't that many people writing my sort of book. And I think my publishers there, Pieper, have promoted them terrifically, always given them beautiful covers and put a great deal of confidence in them right from the beginning, which makes an enormous difference. And I kind of suspect that people think of Britain in some ways is quite romantic, our castles and scenery and that sort of thing. So I think it's a combination of things. And in Germany, people take books very seriously.
And obviously they're translated into German.
Yes.
And your titles sometimes will change, I imagine.
Some are the same, some are different. Some just don't work in German, perhaps even for grammatical reasons. For one reason or another, they just don't work, so they are changed, yes.
And when you're writing, are you thinking of your German market?
Yes.
You are?
I think of both. I think of both, and at the same time, in a way, I think of neither, because it's got to come from the heart. But I do, I mean, for instance, I deliberately don't choose very complicated names that would be very complicated to pronounce. I want people in different parts of the world to be able to say the names of my characters in their heads, that sort of thing. So I do have an awareness of it, yeah, definitely.
Well, as I say, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we're going to hear your first choice of music now, which is Lord Franklin by Pentangle. Why this one?
Partly for personal reasons. I first heard this song when my then boyfriend, now husband of more than 40 years, played it on his cassette player. And I just fell in love with it from the word go. And it's still a song I can listen to with immense pleasure. It hasn't bored me over those years. And it's about the Franklin expedition of the 1840s. It's a lament. It's about love and longing and loss, which I would say a lot of my books are about. And it's a mystery. What happened to the Franklin expedition is a mystery that still hasn't been completely resolved to this day. And still things are being found out about the ship. A couple of the ships were uncovered not that long ago.
Twas homeward bound one night on the Dee, swinging in my hammock, I fell asleep. I dreamed a dream and I thought it true, concerning Franklin and his gallant crew. With 100 seamen he sailed away to the
frozen ocean in the month of May, to seek a passage around the pole, where we poor seamen do sometimes go.
That's Lord Franklin by Pentangle, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Judith Lennox. Judith is a best-selling romantic novelist who has sold over 3.5 million books worldwide. She's published in Germany, France, Italy, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland. I could go on. She's been shortlisted 3 times for the Romantic Novelists Association's Novel of the Year Award and has written a total of 20 novels. Now, Judith, I called you a romantic novelist because... Well, it says that on your website and it says that on your Wikipedia page. But is that how you'd classify? There's a bit more going on there than romance to me, it seems.
Yes, I think so. It depends how you define romance. I think of it as having a generally positive attitude to the world. Although a lot of very difficult things happen in my novels, on the whole, there is a sort of resolution at the end. I would say they have a slightly more optimistic slant about human nature than, say, a crime novel might have. But I also consider myself a historical novelist. Most of my novels are set in the first half of the 20th century. And I mean, in some ways, it's a pity that things have to be categorised. Unfortunately, I think romantic is often used as a slur, and I don't think it should be. There are some terrific, you know, classic novels that, let's face it, are romantic. You could say, you know, Pride and Prejudice, Jane Eyre, those sort of novels.
I wonder if it comes from being a female writer, that because you're writing something set in the past where there is a love story, but that's what people concentrate on rather than the historical element.
I think it's an easy label. It can be used as an easy label. It doesn't have to be a slur. But unfortunately, it often is. And yes, I suspect it's something to do with the fact that they're mostly written by women.
Because there's a lot about family relationships in your books, as well as the romantic element.
Yes. And I'm sure the family relationships are certainly equally as important as the romantic element. And families are what I really enjoy writing about, because the kind of microcosm containing so much love and rivalry and envy and affection and all, you know, that wide variety of emotions. And that's what I enjoy writing about. I would say I enjoy writing about emotions, about what goes on in people's heads, why they do what they do.
And you said that you're interested in how families assign roles. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that as children, you can get sort of categorised as the dutiful one, the slightly rebellious one. You know, some incident can happen and it can attach to a person for years. And maybe after a while, they kind of make themselves into that role. And also, I think that your position in a family has an influence on kind of how you turn out. For instance, I'm the eldest girl in a family of four. I'm second out of four. I have 3 siblings. And I think perhaps, you know, that made me somewhat more responsible, dutiful, towing the line, all that sort of thing, because I used to keep an eye on my younger brother and sister.
Yes, so, and that is very much reflected in your book. So it's almost like a destiny.
Yes. And you obviously are not just that person, but people can sort of, you can end up sort of that part of you concentrating rather than developing all the other bits.
And why do you set them in the past? Because some of the stories, the family element, maybe does that change over time, or why in the past and why not present?
I don't think it does change over time, and I don't think human nature changes over time. I think people have always loved their children, loved their partners. I don't think that changes, but for me, I do sort of verge on politics in my book. books on the historical events, and to be able to look back gives me a perspective that I find easier. Also, if I'm honest, I would kind of struggle to write about, say, the technology nowadays that younger people use. I would struggle to write about it convincingly. I know I would, because I don't totally understand it.
Is there one period of history that interests you more than others? Because I noticed when you first started writing, you were perhaps a little bit further back. You were sort of 17th century, 16th
yes.
century.
Well, I started with the 16th and 17th century because that was the period I studied at school and university. And then after my fourth book, my publisher said to me, historical novels are out of favour. How about the 20th century? So I moved to the 20th century. And I think probably the bit I found most interesting there, the period, is the Between the Wars period, which seemed a real flowering of creative, of art and music and dance, that sort of thing. And also of new ways of living, because people had to react to all the horrors of the First World War. For instance, a lot of women had to grow up without a partner, without children. They didn't have the destiny they might have thought they would have, because so many men had died.
I think that what struck me about your novels, particularly for the women, is that they are very much products of the time that they live in.
Yes, yes, and I want them to be, and I want to be able to show that change that happened to women. And also, of course, I look at my own family. I mean, my mother was born in 1926. She wouldn't have been able to go to university if her brother had chosen to go to university. It would have gone to the brother. The money would have gone to the brother, not to my mother, who was a very able scientist. That she was able to go to university and study biology and microbiology was just the fact that, in a way, her brother decided not to. And I think all too easily we can forget what limitations were put on women's lives for so long.
And you've written 20 novels, Judith.
Yes.
My goodness me, that's quite a rate, that is.
Yes, the first one was published in 1989. And I suppose, yes, I've kept going ever since. And well,
good for you. You're not running out of ideas then, are you?
Not yet, no.
Have you ever written we're going to hear from Victor Watson in a very short while. Have you ever written a novel for children?
No, I haven't. No. I think because a lot of the themes I most enjoy writing about are not all that suitable for children. And it's a real skill of its own.
Absolutely.
The two things are different.
Well, let's hear from Victor now. The four novels in Victor Watson's Paradise Barn Quartet take place in the fictional country town of Great Deeping during the Second World War. The final book in the series, Everyone a Stranger, won the East Anglian Children's Book of the Year Award in 2014. In his professional life, teaching children's literature at Homerton College, Victor wrote and edited several academic books about the subject. So I asked what it was about writing for children that sparked his interest.
There are two answers to that. One is that I knew when I was quite young, 9 or 10, that I just loved reading Jobsley children's books, and that stayed with me when I grew older. And then I was a teacher for several years, teaching English, and I thought it was my job to know quite a lot about children's books so that I could bring them into the classroom. But a particularly big influence was when I worked at Homerton, because with a colleague or two, I established a course on children's literature for intending student teachers. Well, they were student teachers, and most of them were primary teachers, and it's their business to know about children's books. And we ran this course. It was part of the education tripos. So for 20-odd years, I was studying children's literature, the history, the nature, the philosophy of children's books. And at the same time, I was going into schools to watch some of these student teachers actually working with classes of children. I must have been into hundreds of classrooms. And at that time, you could go into a classroom, particularly if you went in at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and you could almost guarantee you'd see a teacher reading poems or folk stories or fairy stories or serialising a novel with a class. So that is why and how I became interested in children's literature.
And you studied children's literature really from the 18th century through to more or less the present day. Have you noticed, has there been a particular shift in children's literature at any time?
I think the changes that have taken place in the last 20 or so years are more or less the same as the changes have taken place in the wider lives of children. To somebody my age, to be honest, it's a bit baffling. Yes, there have been those big changes.
And what would those changes be?
There's a change of language. There's a move, I think, to a faster-moving, more episodic fiction. I'm talking about novels now, than children used to have. One of my favourite writers is Philippa Pierce, another Cambridge author. And I reread one or two of hers occasionally. Now, even to my taste now, seem, wonderful though they are, incredibly slow moving. That's probably the biggest single change, I think. No, there's another one. There is another change, and that is what you can write about in children's books. There are certain things you simply could not have written about in the 30s or 40s or even the 50s.
Would that be some moral issues, separation, sex, even illness?
Sex, I was thinking of. Illness, death, grief, race. Very few of those things were addressed in any significant way before about 1960, I suppose.
So you were studying children's literature and now you're a children's writer. At what stage did you flip?
That was easy. I flipped when I retired. It just seemed silly not to try my hand at doing this particular thing, writing a children's book, when I'd been talking about it and writing about it for years. So that's what I did.
Was it as easy a step as you thought?
It was easy in the sense that I knew what I was aiming for. I knew which authors I admired, and I wanted to aspire to something like that. That made it a bit easier. It certainly didn't make it easier to actually do the writing. Not a bit.
No. And had you identified in your studying these are the factors that make a good children's book or a successful children's book?
Well, they're not necessarily the same, of course. The good book is not always a successful one and the other way around. Yes, I think I had. I certainly knew what I thought constituted good writing for children. I was aiming for that.
And your books are aimed at what age range?
Roughly between 9 and 12, though younger children read them and indeed older adults read them.
And very many are set during wartime?
Of the five that I've published so far, they're all set in World War II, yes.
Why is that?
And that's easy to answer as well. It's not because I have a predilection for war. It's because it seemed to me a good idea if I was writing for 9, 10-year-olds to go back to my own memories of what it was like when I was 9 or 10. And what was happening in my life at that time was, well, the last 2 or 3 years of World War II.
And I suppose in terms of a plot, it gives you quite a lot to go with, doesn't it? There's jeopardy, there are friends and enemies. Is it a period of time that you found children are easily able to plug into as readers?
Yes, though a bit of me, and please don't ask me why because I couldn't tell you, a bit of me suspects that that's going to die out soon. I think it's fading. They have been very interested, and that's partly to do with the school curriculum, which has changed. But I do sense that it's probably wearing a bit thin now. I don't want to write any more books about World War II.
You don't?
I don't want to. I think I've given all I have to say about World War II.
But you're going to continue writing books?
I am continuing to write.
So yeah. Where are you going now then?
Well, I'm trying my hand at a young adult novel, but I'm not going to tell you anything else about it because it's work in progress. And even the Walden writers have only heard the first chapter.
Well, you mentioned the Walden writers there because you're part of this writing group. How important to you is that?
Well, it's become very important. There's a big, wider group of Walden writers, but there's a small group who meet regularly and they exchange ideas about writing and publishing, but they read their work to each other. And there's no sentimentality about it. Nobody's kind. Well, they're all kind, but they don't wrap up what they have to say. And I've learnt an awful lot from them.
And you've written a series of books up until now. Why did you choose to write a series of books? It has advantages and disadvantages, I would imagine.
The biggest thing that drew me towards series, I suspect, was the fact that I loved reading them when I was a boy. It was Swallows and Amazons. And I loved reading them, and I think that was in my mind all the time I was writing my first book. But as I was writing my first book, the second book was already forming in my head. So there was a sequel, and then another one, and so on. But I think it's deeper than that, because I remember talking to some children about reading and writing at a local school many years ago. And one boy, a year six boy, was a great reader of serious fiction, and I asked him why. And he summed it up very pithily, I thought. He said, when you're reading a new single novel, it's like walking into a room full of strangers. But when you're reading a novel in a series, it's like walking into a room full of friends. And that, I think, is actually quite true. And even experienced, sophisticated adult readers admit that they feel a slight wariness in the first chapter of a new book. Are they going to like these characters? Are they going to like the story? Are they going to like the voice of the story? Who belongs to whom? Who's related to whom? Who is quarrelling with someone else? All that's cut out when you go back to a book in a series. And I think that boy put his finger on it when he said it's like walking into a room full of friends. I wanted to tap into that.
And readers like the characters. Presumably you have to like your characters as well, because you're going to stay with them for a while.
Yes, 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 indeed. There are one or two I don't like, and they get disposed of in one way or another. But the ones I like, particularly the three key children, and there are several children, but there are three central ones, yes, I'm very fond of them.
And do you map out, or did you map out where their stories were going, or do you just write and see where they lead you?
I don't plot or map out anything, but I do usually know what the ending's going to be. And it's the start that sets me going anyway. I have an idea, I see an incident or a character, and that gives me an idea for the story. And then I don't really go any further until I've worked out how it's going to end. But I don't plot out the route from the beginning to the end. I think I'd find that boring. Once you've plotted it out, why go any further? You've done it. I like that sense of exploration, which means, of course, you write a lot of stuff that you don't use. In a way, it's hard work.
And what about research? I know you're using a lot of your own memories, but how much additional research did you do about being a child in wartime?
Very little. Very little. And in that respect, I think I'm rather unlike my colleagues in the Walden Writers. I use research to check on facts. So if I need to know when gliders were first used in World War II, I'll look that up. I remember in the fourth novel of the series, which is set in 1945, Everyone a Stranger, when the war ended, I had my main character ordering a banana split in a restaurant in London, and realised I'd better just check when did bananas become available again after the war ended. And I think I had to change that one because I got it wrong. That's, I'm afraid, a little bit ashamed to say, I admit it ruefully, that's pretty well all the research I do. I'm checking on things.
And what about your own time as a reader when you were a child? Is there, you mentioned Swallows and Amazons earlier, is there another book that you go back to?
There's one particular book that I read a lot when I was a child. It's called The Ship That Flew by Hilda Lewis, published in the Oxford series. I read that over and over. I just loved it. But series, Biggles books. Malcolm Savile wrote a series called The Lone Pine Five. That mostly went on beyond the time when I was reading them, but the first four or five I read and I reread. I was a great rereader, and that's a big difference. There are people fall into two groups. There are either readers or rereaders, and they're very different, and I was a rereader.
That's Victor Watson there, and the Paradise Barn series is published by Catnip. Are you a rereader?
I am definitely a rereader, yes. I mean, as a child, I used to read a book a day, and I didn't have a huge amount of books, so I would read them over and over again. I can still, even now, remember some of the first paragraphs off by heart of those books that I loved. And still, if I really enjoy a book, I will reread it. I would agree totally with what he just said.
And would you agree with him about plotting? Because he's saying he doesn't plot.
No, I have to plot. My books are 140 to 150,000 words long. There's no way I could not plot, in a sense. I would totally agree that I need to know what the end is. I need to know where the book is going. But I write a synopsis, which I show to my editor and agent for their comments. Doesn't mean that I'll keep rigidly to it, and it doesn't mean that a lot of other ideas won't spring up while I'm writing, but I do have to have a framework before I start.
And this idea of the first chapter, the wariness that a reader does feel in the first chapter, presumably you're aware of that when you're writing.
Yes, very much, and very much so. And I was interested with the by the comment that writing has to be faster moving than it used to be. And I think that's definitely true. And nowadays, for some time now, I've had to think, well, people can look at the first few pages on Amazon. If it doesn't grab them on Amazon, they might not bother reading any further if those first few pages don't hold their attention. So something's got to, you've got to plunge the reader immediately into the story nowadays.
And how do you do that?
a variety of methods with The Jeweller's Wife, my most recently published novel. It talks immediately about my heroine's marriage, which is a pretty difficult marriage. So it gets into that straight away. And she also meets a very significant person in her life within the first few pages of the novel. So you're setting up conflicts right from the word go.
And a hook.
And a hook, yeah, very much so.
Well, let's take a break for some music now. This is your second choice of music. This is Glenn Miller and his orchestra, A Nightingale Sung in Berkeley Square. Why this one?
Because, as I said, I've always been very interested in the interwar period. This was written towards the interwar period. Towards the end of that period, the late 1930s, it seems to me to express a lot of the glamour of that era. Obviously, there's a whole other side to the 1930s of desperate poverty and political conflict, but I wanted to show that. It also has a personal sort of echo for me in that I once had this song dedicated to me by a jazz singer in a bar in Tokyo, which was a rather special event. So,
on Cambridge 105 with Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations rather than books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest today is romantic historical novelist Judith Lennox. We had that discussion earlier. If you missed it, I think we can agree on that.
Romantic slash historical.
And you teased us there with a little bit about your latest novel, The Jeweller's Wife. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay, well, it starts in 1938, and it goes on. It sort of goes over the next two decades to the mid
60s.
It's sprawling, but not that sprawling. Yes, I suppose the starting point was that I wanted to write about a bad marriage, not just a tricky, difficult marriage, but one that really is a bad idea from the word go. And I also wanted to show how a marriage like that can affect the children, how it can affect the next generation, because it starts with the central character, Juliet, has just married her husband, Henry Winterton. She's starting to realise it's not going to be easy. But then as the novel goes on, they have children. There are other members of the family also have children. So it's quite an extended family. And some of the attention moves on to the children over the course of the decades.
Now, as you say, it's a big canvas you're working with there. You've got several families over a period of 30 years or so. It's very ambitious, Judith.
Yes, I suppose so, yes.
Was it daunting?
It is daunting, and that's why, as I said earlier, that I do have to plan. I do have to work it all out. I have to know the ages of my characters, for instance. Throughout the whole period, I have to. The only way I can do it is writing them out on squared paper. I couldn't keep track otherwise. I have to know where they're living, what they're doing, all that sort of thing. But I do enjoy it. I think it's seeing how the behaviour of one person affects the behaviour of another person. So in this one, it's a lot of how the parents are affect the children.
It's a great read, I must say. I've very much enjoyed it, the way the characters' lives weave together. How you kept all that in your head, I have no idea. But it's mainly Juliet's story.
Yes, it very much focuses on Juliet, who is a young woman right at the beginning of the novel. And it follows her story through. And she goes through a lot of trials and tribulations. And she grows as a person. At the beginning, she's quite naive, although she's very experienced in some ways. She's had a very peripatetic childhood, travelling around the world with her father. And she has experience of poverty. She's also taken a lover in the past. But then she finds herself married to Henry Winterton, middle-class man, well-off. He is the jeweller of the title. And she doesn't know the sort of things a middle-class woman of that era was supposed to know. She doesn't know how to handle the servants. She doesn't know how to order her dresses from a couturier.
Yes, and that's part of, well, not her downfall, is it, but her awakening.
How she educates herself, how she becomes able to accept her life, what she is, how she blossoms and eventually finds happiness.
And it's set on the Blackwater estuary of Essex, and the estuary is very much a character, some lovely landscape writing. Why there?
Partly because my previous novel was set in South Devon. So that's a landscape of, it's the sea, the cliffs, the bays, the combes, that sort of landscape. And I needed to change, and I thought I would do a marshy, misty sort of landscape. Also, causeways feature in the book, causeways and islands. I wanted to write about the idea of a landscape that doesn't stay the same. There's land that's sometimes there and sometimes isn't. It disappears, it reappears, and it traps people, and it allows them to behave in ways they otherwise wouldn't have behaved. And that reflects how my characters behave in the book.
And as you say, the causeways, the islands become a metaphors for isolation and for connection.
Yes, and for, doing things you otherwise wouldn't be able to do. Some of the characters behave quite badly. But also it is a very beautiful landscape. It's in a quiet, grey, murky sort of way. I became very entranced with it when I went there.
How much research do you have to do for a book like this?
A lot. As I've been writing in the same period for quite a long time, obviously I have built up a reasonable amount of knowledge over the years. We went to explore that area, I don't know, probably about four times, stayed there a couple of times, something like that, so that I could see it in its different seasons and moods. So I think if you are writing about landscape, you do kind of have to soak yourself in it.
And all those things that you mentioned about a woman of the time and the expectations living in the grand place that she does as well. Have you already got that information in your head from previous novels?
I keep reading all the time. I read factual books. I read biographies of people who lived in the era I find particularly useful. I just try and keep soaking myself in it so that I keep acquiring knowledge. And also that gives me new ideas of new things to write about.
Well, it is a cracking story. I do recommend it. And speaking of storytellers, that leads us nicely into our second interview of the show. In 2007, Chip Colquhoun co-founded Snail Tales, a storytelling company aimed at children. Since then, he's written the EU Guide to Storytelling in Schools and his first book, Cambridgeshire Folk Tales for Children, which he says inspired his current book, Who Made England? I asked him how.
Yes, it really did, because it's the story of the eel catcher's daughter from Ely, which inspired both the theatre show, The First King of England in a Dress, and yes, this entire book, because when I discovered that King Canute, the character of King Canute, had such an interesting relationship with the people of East Anglia, it did make me want to really explore his role, not only in the Kingdom of East Anglia, but in the whole Kingdom of England. This whole part of the world had a very poor relationship with foreigners as far as history went. We had the Viking slaughter of the East Anglian armies, you know, it's where we have the name Bury St Edmunds from. We've also got the whole history of Hereward the Wake and all of the sort of anti-Norman battles going on. And then randomly in the middle of all of that, you've got a story about a Viking king who makes very close friends with the English people from around here. I think that's enough to get anyone intrigued about the character and the relationship with the locality. And the more I looked into Canute, the more I realised that not only was he quite significant and important in this area, but he really was the first king of England. He was the first one to be recognised as such by his contemporaries. And it then made me wonder, well, why doesn't anybody else call him that? Because if you go to modern history books, they have titles like Æthelstan, the first king of England, and he was a king who was about 70 years before Canute. There are other books that describe Alfred as being the first king of England. There are others that talk about Edgar being the first king of England. And the more I looked into it, the more I saw that actually England didn't exist until Canute. There's no record of a country called England until Canute becomes the king of that country. It really did just inspire me to start putting into book form all of the research that I had done into all of these different characters from the Dark Ages, the Anglo-Saxon kings and queens, and Canute himself, and share it with others so that we could get their feedback.
And of course, with Canute, most of us think about that story about him trying to turn back the sea. Mm-hmm. And you talk a lot in the book about folk story and folklore and fact and what one can tell us about the other.
I do come to this from a storyteller point of view rather than an historian point of view. With this particular period of history, you have to do that because pretty much all of the records we have were written by a very tiny minority of people. You just would not have read or written. To have that skill, you needed to be either a monk or someone royal. As a result, our entire historical record for that period is both small and biased.
And what age group is this book aimed at?
It's aimed at 7 to 11. And the reason I got asked to write it for that age group is because it's published by the History Press, who published Cambridgeshire Folk Tales for Children. They know me best as a storyteller who writes for children. So when I came to them with all of my research and said, I'd really like to write this all down, they said, well, we're happy for you to do that as long as you keep it within that age range. And I'm kind of glad that they did, because although in my mind it was a much more academic book, at the same time, having to write it for such a young age group forced me to make sure that it was accessible to everybody. I even know that I've got some readers below 7, but I know I've got plenty of readers above the age of 11 who have thoroughly enjoyed this book.
And it doesn't mean that it can't be provocative.
Well, absolutely. I certainly hope so. But that's one of the reasons why the book is kind of interactive too, because I recognise that this period of history is sort of open to interpretation. Anything that involves fiction is going to be open to interpretation, and folklore is kind of a blend between the news that people were telling and their own little embellishments of it that they were sort of adding in and tweaking as they went along. What I've done in the book is I've given people the opportunity to read the facts, read the folklore, read what I say about it, what I think about it, but also make their own opinions. There's plenty of space in there for people to make their own opinions. And I am very open about the bits that are my opinion. And at the end of each chapter, there is an opportunity for you to list down how you would score each of the characters on their contribution to the foundation of England.
Yes, the scoring system. I'm quite intrigued by this. So you're scoring key figures on what?
The categories that we're scoring them on are their power, so how powerful a ruler they were, I suppose, how many kingdoms they had conquered, their popularity, and by that I mean how much people liked them at the time, their influence on what came next, and whether you think, therefore, they are a maker of England. So just to give a really good example, Alfred the Great, a character that a lot of people know, both from the facts and from the folklore, because of burning the cakes and stories like that. He was quite a powerful man. You know, he managed to keep Wessex going, even though Vikings ruled pretty much every other Anglo-Saxon kingdom across Britain at that time. And he's also very popular. Even at the time, he managed to bring all of his people together. His biggest score, though, would be the influence on what came next, because Alfred is credited with calling the Saxons English. And he did lots of other things to build up the England that would come, such as setting up what we now think of as counties. And his Maker of England score is therefore going to be quite high. But it's not going to be the highest in the book, because he did not make England. At the time that Alfred died, the whole idea of there being a country called England did not exist, because, yes, he was an English king, but his country was Wessex. His friends were in countries like Mercia and Kent. The Vikings were in countries like East Anglia and Northumbria. So there wasn't an England.
So to find out who does get the top score, we're going to have to read the book.
Well, yes, but also I would love to know what the readers' top scores are. You know, I like seeing the various reviews that I'm getting on Amazon where people are saying where they disagree with me or where they agree with me.
And what's the most interesting fact you found out during the research for this book?
I think that has to be the fact that England is 1,000 years old. I find it interesting mainly because it is so relevant to today. England was born because one man, this king called Canute, who was a foreign ruler, remember, you know, he had essentially invaded the country, and he had all of these different tribes all around him, and he managed to get in place the longest period of peace that the island of Britain had seen since the Romans. I don't think that can really be divorced from the fact that he was the man who started the country of England. He found a way of uniting all of these different kingdoms, giving them one name and saying, look, don't think of yourselves as someone from Wessex now or someone from Mercia. Don't think territorially. Think we are now all in this together. And that is such a pertinent message for now, pretty much exactly 1,000 years on. We really need to hear what Canute was saying about being all together and respecting our neighbours. You could see it as a nationalist thing. It's England's 1,000th birthday. Yay for England and being English. But it is also something that we can be proud of, that England didn't come together because of rebellion or revolution or anything particularly violent. What we have then is a kingdom that is born entirely out of people coming together. And that's something I think we can be proud of and something that we should celebrate on the 7th of January next year.
Yeah, well, that's a date then, isn't it? Who Made England? The Saxon Viking Race to Create a Country by Chip Colquhoun is published by the History Press. I've Judith Lennox with me, a studio guest on Bookmark. We're coming to the end of our time with you, sadly, Judith. But what's next for you then?
I have completed a book this year and it's called Hidden Lives, and it'll be published in Britain in January of next year. So that's what's next. And I've just started working on ideas for a new novel.
Do you go to Germany particularly to promote your books?
I've been once or twice. I think so much is done on the internet these days. So no, not an enormous amount. I've been to see my publishers there quite a few times and very much enjoyed going there.
And your writing routine, you aim to write 1,500 to 2,000 words a day, is that right?
I aim to. I don't always manage it. Yes, I would say that's what I aim for. It's probably tailed off a bit recently. And I aim to write a book in 18 months.
Which is impressive, full stop, but it's particularly remarkable as you've got scoliosis and you spoke, I'm not asking you anything that you haven't spoken about publicly before.
Yeah, that's right. And for those who don't know, scoliosis is a spine that curves laterally. It's what Richard III had. And I was diagnosed in my mid-teens. At the time where I lived, there was no treatment at all for it. So basically, I coped with increasing pain over the next years. And then miraculously, 7 years ago, I was operated on at Adam Brooks, had a 6.5-hour operation on my spine, which straightened it. And the level of pain has been reduced just fantastically. So I'm eternally grateful to Adam Brooks and my surgeon and his team there.
Wow, that's brilliant. Oh, what a change in life that must mean for
totally,
you.
Totally, totally. I'm even taller than I used to be. I grew over an inch in my mid-50s. But not being in pain a lot of the time is just, it just makes life so much easier. It really does. And I quite often, at the same time as Open Studios, I put on a weekend at our house selling tea and cakes in aid of the Scoliosis Association, because it's not a condition that's very widely known, and I would like people to understand it a bit more.
And has it influenced what you've written in any way, do you think, having that condition?
I think you can't, if you've got something like that and you get it as early as I got it, I don't think you can separate yourself from it. It shaped my body and it shaped my life. I don't consider myself defined by it, but I think, yes, certainly it, I'm sure it has shaped my writing as well, definitely.
Well, it's nice to hear a story with a happy ending, frankly.
Yes.
One final question that we ask all our guests. What are you reading at the moment?
At the moment, I'm reading a book by Madeleine Bunting called Love of Country, and it's about the Western Scottish islands, the Hebrides, also the Orkneys, all that part of Scotland. I'm married to a Scot. I've always been fascinated by that part of the country. We've travelled there quite often. And she's discussing the history and the geography and the traditions of that part of Scotland. And I would thoroughly recommend it.
Is this going to appear in a future novel, do you think?
I don't know. I haven't decided yet.
Because I imagine your novels are so all-encompassing that almost everything you read can find a place there.
Yes, it certainly had a thought about setting part of a novel in that part of the country. It certainly had an influence on me picking up the book.
Excellent. Well, we'll come back to you again finally for just a moment. But our next show on Bookmark, our studio guest is explorer and survival expert Justin Miles. We'll also hear from performance poet Neil Hilborn, and Joe Herbert will be talking about his book on testosterone. It's quite a macho show. That one's going to be, I think. Go to our Facebook page and please like us there. There's also on the Facebook page a chance to win a signed copy of Judith's novel, The Jeweller's Wife, which I should say is published by Headline Books. All podcasts of Old Bookmarks are on the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.co.uk. If you don't go to the website, then do visit our sponsor, Heffer's Bookshop, the best bookshop in Cambridge. And we'll see you next time. But we're signing out now with your last choice of music today, Judith, which is the Alleluia from Mozart's Exultate Jubilate. Why this one?
It's because it's such a joyful piece of music. I can't remember where I first heard it. I belong to a choir in Cambridge, and we sang this piece last year, and I just enjoyed it thoroughly. You know, I defy anybody not to feel cheered up by this piece of music.
And but being part of a choir, which is sort of another question for you, but being part of a choir, that's tapping a different creative side of you, I guess.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I go along there on a Monday night, and I always come away feeling terrific. It's just such a great experience to sing with other people.